much for coming. I was going to talk a little bit about Around the World in 80 Faiths and some of the other television programs that rather strangely I became involved with. I'll talk a little bit first about how I actually became a television presenter. Then I'll talk a little bit about what happens to the license fee that we all pay to the BBC, how that's being spent. I'll talk a little bit about how documentaries are actually put together. And then I'll talk a little about some of the experiences I had whilst filming that sadly didn't make it onto the screen. And then if there's enough time after that, I might read a section from a book that I wrote in a cave in the Sinai Desert whilst filming a series called Extreme Pilgrim. Does that all sound okay? Right, okay. Currently, I'm a Church of England parish priest. I look after three tiny little parishes on the Sussex Downs. I'm a non-stipendary vicar, so that means the church give me a house, and then I just get on with it from there. Before I was working where I'm currently working, I was a full-time parish priest, and I was looking after four parishes just outside Cambridge. And I had a study in the house, but my children were very young at the time, and so I moved into a shed in the garden so that people weren't threatened when they came into the house. And I was sitting in my shed one afternoon, and the phone went, and it was a gentleman who said that he was from the BBC and that he just read a book that I'd written and that they were looking for a Christian priest to present a small series called The Battle for Britain's Soul, and could he come down and have a chat? And I said, I'd never presented anything in my life. And he said, that doesn't matter, which was a bit of a concern. Anyway, so he came down the next day, and we had a chat. And then he said, well, look, Pete, I'd like you to come for a screen test. And I thought, so limousines, gin and tonic in the back, gliding up to London. He said, no, I'm going to give you a train ticket. You've got to go to a church in the East End, and there'll be lots of other vicars there from lots of other Christian denominations, and I'm going to screen test a lot of you on one day. And so I said, okay. And I didn't tell anyone that this had happened, so 2 weeks later I went down to London. I turned up at this church. I was shown into the vestry, and it was all full of men wearing black. Yeah. Black shirts, black trousers, black shoes, black jackets. And I sort of tipped up looking much like this. And I looked at him and I thought, there is no chance on this beautiful planet that I will ever get this job. And so for the screen test, I had to walk and talk into a camera at the same time, which is apparently very difficult. I found that very easy. I had to describe a stained glass window. And then I had to transcribe some Latin, which had been written on a tomb. And I did all that. And the director said, well, thank you very much. I'll be in touch within 3 or 4 weeks, and just to let you know. And I went back, and I went straight back to work, and that was it. 10 weeks passed, and I hadn't heard from him. So I thought, oh, well, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And I was in my study, and the phone went. Picked it up. He said, hello, remember me? And I went, well, vaguely. And he said, you've got the job. And I went, okay. When do we start? And he said, we start on Monday. And this was Wednesday. And I was looking after four parishes, and I hadn't told anyone. So I then had to phone round, and I had a meeting with all those who so very kindly helped run the churches. I had to phone the bishop. That was an interesting conversation. And then all the people that I was working with in the churches were all incredibly supportive. They all said, look, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. You must do it. And so that Sunday afternoon, a hire car arrived. I drove myself up to Hunstanton in North Norfolk. Lovely sunny honey, where the crew was staying in the old Hunstanton Hotel. I walked into the bar. It was immediately obvious who the crew were. I went up, introduced myself, bought them a drink, and then we all sat down for supper. And then that night, I got the most terrible food poisoning. I won't talk you through the details of that. And when we're filming, we work 12-hour days. We don't do an 8-hour day. So if we start, if the camera starts turning over at 7 in the morning, then we finish at 7 at night. And again, if we start at 9 in the morning, then we finish at 9 in the evening. We might stop for half an hour at lunchtime, but otherwise we just work and work right the way through. And so the alarm went off at 5:30. We had a 6:30 start. And I went down to breakfast and I went to the director and I said, I'm really sorry. I've had a terrible night. I don't think I'm going to be able to do it today. And he looked at me and said, are you dying? And I went, no, I don't think so. And he said, well, look, Pete, we just carry on. He said, everything's in place. And I went, okay. And so I sat down to breakfast and I just had a bit of water and some fruit. And then he casually turned to me and said, you can ride, can't you? And I said, well, I might be able to manage a trot. And he said, that's fine. A trot's all we need. And so we met down at the end of this place called Queen Anne's Drive, which is in Hocombe. Hocombe is this wonderful, wonderful North Norfolk beach, sort of bordered by pines. And all the crew were ribbing me on as we drove towards Hocombe because there'd been a program filmed by Channel 4 called 100 Things to Do Before You Die. And one of them was to ride a horse across Hocombe Sands. And I was getting it for free. Anyway, so we all parked up down at the end of this long drive, and I was waiting, and all the this camera equipment was being unpacked, and the director said, well, just go and wait over there for the horse to arrive. So I was standing there, and this massive, great, articulated lorry pulls in with animal actors written on the side of it, and it parks up, and this very smartly dressed young woman in a hacking jacket and jumpers gets out, goes around to the back, and leads out this huge black mare, yeah? And so I sort of sidle up to her and say, hello, I'm the presenter. And she goes, oh, well, lovely to meet you. This is the horse. I go, yes, yes. And then I say, is he all right? And she turns to me and said, well, it's a mare, and she's fine. And then she says, you're a bit nervous, aren't you? And I went, yes, I am. And she said, well, look, there's nothing to worry about. The last rider of this horse was a very nervous rider like yourself, and his name was Mel Gibson. Do you remember Mel Gibson's horse in Braveheart? This beautiful black mare. This was Mel Gibson's Braveheart black mare horse. And she said, look, really, these horses, they're trained, to never do anything untoward. And so I mounted up, and she led me on the lead rein down through this beautiful pine forest. And I could remember a bit of the riding I'd done when I was 8 or 9 years old. So I sort of said, okay, I think I can take her from here. And I led her down to the edge of this beach, and she took one look at this vast expanse of golden sand and just took off. And I'd never galloped in my life, ever. And all I could think of was Channel 4 racing, Channel 4 racing. And the jockeys don't sit on the saddle when they're galloping. They kind of crouch. And so I was sort of kind of crouching, yelling, whoa! And eventually, after about 1.5 miles, I managed to rein her in. It was a miracle that I didn't fall off. And I dismounted, and we had a little chat. And then I mounted back up again, and I literally just followed her footprints back to where I could see the crew who'd set up the camera in the dunes. And as I approached the dunes, the director could see him, and he yelled at me, said, that was great, Pete. Could you do that again, please? At which point my language was a little fruity, and that was the first day. And we filmed our 12 hours. I had no idea that what was to come after that little series would be the most incredible journeys of a lifetime, traveling around the planet over 9 times, visiting over 60 different countries, meeting some of the most extraordinary men and women practicing their own religions on the planet. I had no idea that any of that was to come. I thought that this little series would appear and the critics would panic. The Church Times would definitely panic, which they did. And then that would be it, and I would go back to the job that I absolutely love, being a parish priest. I had no idea that what unfolded from there was coming. Just a little bit about how documentaries are made. When we're filming for a one-hour documentary, we film anything usually between 30 and 60 hours worth of film. That then gets edited down into 1 hour. Where the disagreements start is really in the editing process. Because if you've got 46 hours worth of film, it's possible to make almost 10 completely disconnected programs from the material that you have. And so actually trying to tread a narrative path through all of that material becomes very, very difficult. And I can only say that in all my time working for the BBC, I have never seen any sleight of hand. What you saw on the television was what happened. For the last three series that I've made, there was no script. As a presenter, to have a script is such a luxury because you're sort of anchored to something. And I was working with this wonderful director who said, well, look, we're going to be filming in all of these different parts of the world. It would be impossible to write a script, so let's just try them without a script. And so we got to the point where we would just arrive, we'd get the camera going, and we'd go and film whatever happened. And we never went back and did something again. So if we got it, we got it, and if we missed it, we missed it. Just a little bit about the license fee. I was working in the early 80s, I was working in the advertising industry. And the first television commercial that I wrote was for a product called Rivita. And it was a 30-second television commercial. It was directed by Terence Donovan. And in the early 80s, a 30-second television commercial cost the Rivita company £86,000. That was the bill. The last series, full series that I worked on with the BBC was called How to Live a Simple Life. One-hour program cost you and I £76,000. So when it comes to program making, we are getting incredibly good value for money. What happens in the upper echelons of the BBC in terms of executive pay, I don't even want to look at. But when it comes to program making, we're getting very good value for money. When we're filming abroad, we don't go and large it up in swanky hotels. We stay in low to mid-range hotels. And then if we're filming somewhere where it's difficult and potentially dangerous, we stay in people's houses and we kip down on the floor. We're given a budget of £7 for lunch and £12 for dinner, and that's applicable wherever we are in the world. In the UK, that's actually quite tough. If you're filming in India, then you can live like a king. But that's the going rate. Money is not wasted. They are incredibly diligent with your license fee and my license fee as well. Is that okay? Yeah? All right. Has anyone been to Ethiopia? Yes, one or two people. Yeah. Do you remember the footage shot by Michael Burke during the famine? The incredibly iconic footage shown on, I think it was Channel 4 at the time, where he was reporting from the refugee camps in Tigray. What we couldn't see from that footage was what an incredibly beautiful land Ethiopia is. We'd gone there to film their most important religious festival. And we were filming in the province of Tigray. Tigray had been one of the epicenters of the famine that took place. And whilst we were driving through, it became immediately apparent, first of all, that it felt very underpopulated. And there were a lot of empty houses. The Tigrayan houses are very simple, single-story, mud brick-built buildings with a corrugated iron roof, but many of them were empty. And secondly, when you drove through villages, you became aware that at some point in the very near past, half the planet had arrived in this place and now they'd gone. So in the middle of this tiny village, there'd be a huge basketball pitch with a sign on the side of it saying that it had been sponsored by the American government, or this water station had been sponsored by the Spanish. And everywhere you went, it was as if the whole world had been there at some point. Christianity would have arrived in Ethiopia probably 50 or so years after the life of Christ. It would have seeped down through Egypt. The first Ethiopian Christians met in secret because they were very fearful of the reaction of the indigenous religion of the time to their new faith. And they would meet in secret on these rocky outcrops, rather like tors, which you'll find in the Tigrayan landscape. And they would meet up there and say their prayers in secret. As Christianity became more accepted by the Ethiopian population, rather than build churches, what they did was actually hollow out these rocks that they had been meeting around. And these became the rock-hewn churches of Ethiopia. And we drove through the Ethiopian landscape to arrive. We arrived just beneath one of these wonderful rocks. It was a really rough ladder, so we carried all our kit up it. We walked around a little plateau, and we were greeted by an Ethiopian Coptic priest. As I said, we were there to film their most important festival. In the light of the famine, their most important religious festival is now Harvest Festival. When we think of a Harvest Festival, we think of scrabbling around in some cupboard 20 minutes before the service for a can of pineapple chunks or Jolly Green Giant sweet corn. I spoke a little bit about that an hour ago. And then we turn up and we sing, we plow the fields and scatter, and the service sort of lasts for an hour or so, then we might have a chat afterwards, and then we're home. Here, the service started at 6 in the evening and went on right the way through the night, till 5 in the morning. All the local priests turned up. Every single man, woman, and child from the parish attended. Everyone crammed into this little church. The chanting started at 6 o'clock in the evening and went on till 5 o'clock in the morning, just chanting for 11 hours. If you wanted to sleep, you could go outside and lie down, and there was a little corner in the church set aside for mothers who were nursing young children. At 5 o'clock, we all processed outside. A holy icon was processed around the plateau, and then we all sat down and watched the sun come up over this extraordinarily beautiful land. And that was it. We were done. And then there was a feast of Ethiopian flatbread and a liqueur that the Ethiopians brew. It's like a honey wine. It's called tej. And we were told, those of us who were working for the BBC, were told that we could eat the flatbread, but on no account were we to touch the wine. And so we were sort of hanging around. And then this parish priest came up and said, "It's been a long night. I'm going back to my house for breakfast. Would you like to join us?" And when you're filming abroad and traveling between sort of mid-range hotels, if someone says, "Would you like to come back to my house?" it's such a wonderful invitation, because you begin to see the intimacies and the real manner in which people are currently living, rather than the manner in which they want to present it to you. And so I said, "Yes, we'd love to come back." And so we started following this gentleman down this track through the land. And he was leading us to what appeared to be quite a grand, what looked like quite a grand white house, which sat on the brow of a hill. And as I said, the Ethiopian houses are very simple, single-story mud brick-built dwellings. And we went in through a door on the outside into a cattle yard, which was about the size of this room. This enormous cattle yard had about 9 or 10 cattle within it. And on the other side of the cattle yard was an even smaller door. And he led us through this door into one room. And there was a beaten earth floor. There was a little bit of bedding on the floor in one corner. In another corner, there was a clay oven. And his wife was cooking some breakfast. And that was all there was. There was nothing else at all, and this was where he lived. And I was given a plate and some flatbread and a little dried fruit, and I was feeling pretty weary, so I went and sat on the step between the house and the cattle yard, And within about a minute, this Ethiopian priest came and sat down next to me. And we were eating. And then he turned to me and he said, "I've been to London." And at sort of 6:45 in the morning in Tigray, London could not have seemed further away. And whenever we were filming, I would always ask people what they thought of England. What were their impressions of Great Britain, of the United Kingdom? I was always fascinated to hear what they thought about us. And so I said, "Well, what did you think? What did you think of London, of England?" And he paused and he said, "Your houses, they're full of stuff." He said, "You have so much stuff." And I went, "Yeah, yeah, we do, don't we?" And then he looked at me and he said, When in the West did you forget how to share?" And I can't answer him. And I wish we'd filmed that conversation. I wish we had. Has anyone been to Vanuatu? One person. It's two people. It's a rare thing. Vanuatu used to be called the New Hebrides, and they are a Polynesian island nation. And the New Hebrides, up until 1980, the New Hebrides was a joint French and British protectorate. How anyone in their right mind thought anything like that would ever work is completely beyond me. But in 1980, the Vanuatans gained their independence, and it's as far away as you can get from here as is physically possible. It's a four-hour flight east of Brisbane. You know when you're young and someone shows you a picture in a book or on the wall, and it's of a sort of curve of an arc of a white sand beach, and in front is some aquamarine sea, a couple of palm trees, maybe a little shack, and you're told that this is paradise. Why paradise should always be somewhere else, I think, is another bigger question for another day. And if you walk down Cirencester High Street, if you walk down Cheltenham High Street, there in the picture of the travel agent's windows, you'll see this image that's sold to us in the West of being paradise. And suddenly, I was there. I'd never been anywhere like it. And the wind truly is lyrical, and the pace of life is slow, and it is hot, and there is sand without feet, and it is mesmerically seductive. What we're not shown in those posters is the aching poverty that exists on those islands. And just to demonstrate how pertinent, how deep this image of this distant paradise is within the West, when I was working in the advertising industry, there was a 30-second commercial for Guinness. And it opened on a yacht. And the yacht was moored in this paradise bay of white sand, aquamarine sea. And there was a young man lying on board the deck in the arms of a Polynesian woman. And she was stroking his hair. And he went to sleep. And the screen went all fuzzy, and he went into a dream sequence. And in his dream, he was standing in an English pub in front of a dartboard holding a pint of Guinness. Yeah? And then the screen went all fuzzy, and he woke from his dream, and he looked into the eyes of this woman, and he said, "I've just been to paradise." We were filming on the southernmost island of the Vanuatan island chain. It was an island called Tanna. The one distinguishing feature about the island of Tanna is that it has a live volcano. So every 3 or 4 minutes, there's this massive great boom, and that carries on throughout the day and the night. The people living on the island pay no attention to it whatsoever. And we'd arrived, the Japanese had just built a little tiny airport, so we flew in. It took us 4 hours to drive across the island, which was 8.5 miles. We then arrived in a tiny little bay called Port Resolution, where we were staying in some little shacks, sleeping on the floor. And we were eating a very simple supper, and the director came in and said, would anyone like to go and film up at the volcano tomorrow? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. And everyone else said, yes. He said, well, I'll just go and ask permission. And then he came back saying, well, we don't need permission. Apparently, you just follow that track, and we just follow the signs, and we can go. And so we got up at 5:30. We loaded up our Land Rover. We drove down the track, which we'd been told to drive down. And there, nailed to a palm tree, was a black and white sign, which simply said, volcano. And there was an arrow underneath it, heading off to the right. So we took a right, and then we drove up through, we got above the tree line, and then the ground started smoking. There's this acrid smell of sulfur, and we parked up as high as we could, and there was a tiny little path leading through this moonscape, so we lugged all our kit up there, and 2 or 3 minutes later, there we were, standing on the rim of this volcano. I was looking down into this cauldron of fire and smoke. It was incredible. And the sound man who was standing on my left, who was the son of the Albanian ambassador, was a really wonderful man. And he said, do you know really what I like about this place, Pete? And I went, no. What, mate? And he said, the complete absence of health and safety notices. And it hadn't crossed my mind. Imagine if there was a volcano on Dartmoor. Imagine the rigmarole we would all be put through just to go and stand on the lower slopes. You know, we'd all be dressed in white boiler suits. We'd have to wear orange hard hats. We'd have to undergo a health and safety briefing. We'd then have to sign some sort of form of indemnity saying we weren't going to sue the National Parks Authority if a piece of lava landed on us and we came to an end. Here, you can go where you want, do what you want, pretty much. And there are no signs saying you can't. I understand the reasons for health and safety. But when you're working in countries where that doesn't exist, there is a sense of freedom which we have lost here. We did need permission to film in the afternoon up in the tribal villages. The new government of Vanuatu do not encourage tourism within the interior of the southern islands. Within the island of Tana, there were probably 12 or so, 15 tribal groupings living within the rainforest. And we were very, very privileged to be able to go and film there. And we were going to interview the tribal elders about their religious beliefs. And so we drove through the jungle and we parked up. And as we were driving through the jungle, our translator explained that the last Western Caucasian men and women that they'd seen in the village were 25 years ago when a couple of Australians inadvertently stumbled into the village. Some of the men living in the village had jobs on the coast, and so they would have seen people with predominantly white skin. But otherwise, he said, most people under 25 would not have seen anyone with white skin before. And we... he also said the last instance of cannibalism within the village we were visiting took place in 1974. So there would be tribal elders who, as younger men and women, took part in that ceremony. And so we parked up, and as this was a formal interview, I said to the director, I'll see you up there. And he said, okay, Pete, I'll meet you up there. And there was a path which was in front of me, a straight path of about 100 yards. And at the end of it, I could just see the edges of some thatched dwellings. And I started walking up the path. And after about 50 or 60 yards, I became aware of this rustling in the bushes either side of me. And so I stopped. And I looked to my left and I looked to my right. And then as I looked forward again, this little troop of about between 10 and 12 children emerged from the jungle silently, and they were naked, and they stood there and they were looking at me, and I was looking at them, and I didn't know what to do. And so instinctively I just crouched, I got down on my haunches, and then they ran at me, and they grabbed my hat, and they were pulling at my clothes and laughing at my hair, and I didn't know what to say. So I was saying, oh, it's so lovely, that we're here and aren't the butterflies beautiful and aren't you lovely? And they were all talking to me all at once. And I thought, well, I can't stay down here. So I went to pick up the tripod that I was carrying. And then they grabbed my hands. And then they started singing. They started singing. And then they pulled me up the hill into the village. And it was such an experience of innocence. It's not that the children in our land are bad or wicked, or that they are somehow any better. It's just that I'd never experienced that degree of real innocence and happiness before. I can't go into my village and be greeted like that. I don't expect to be so. And so to be greeted like that was incredibly moving. I found it incredibly moving. And the director came up and he could see that I was welling up. And he said, well, what's the matter? And I explained to him what had happened. And he said, oh, I wish we'd filmed that. And I wish we'd filmed that too. Not to be patronizing in any way, but just to say that it was a beautiful experience. We did our formal interview with the tribal elders, and having done that, the director then said, oh, I'm just going back to the Land Rover, because he would always travel with a bag of sweets and some nuts. And then he came back a couple of minutes later looking rather peeved. And I said, well, what's the matter? And he said, everything, sweets, the nuts, they've all been stolen. I went, stolen? And he said, yes, there's a little trail of sweetie papers leading off into the jungle. Stolen by the same beautiful, innocent children that I was describing to you not 2 minutes ago. It just goes to show that, you know, light and dark, we inherit, all humanity inherit light and dark, and we are no lighter and no darker than our brothers and sisters elsewhere on this wonderful planet. Has anyone been to India? I'm sure many people have been to India. My only advice to everyone who hasn't been to India is allow yourself one long-haul flight and go. It is an extraordinary, the most spiritual land I have ever visited. We were making a television program called Extreme Pilgrim, and I was to follow in the footsteps of two Indian sadhus. Sadhus are Hindu holy men who have renounced all property. They are peripatetic. They lead a life wandering and begging from town to town, city to city, village to village. They don't cut their hair. And on certain festival days, they strip naked and cover themselves in ash and still carry on with their peripatetic lifestyle. I was to meet them at the Kumbh Mela. Has anyone been to the Kumbh Mela in India? The Kumbh Mela is a Hindu festival, and it happens once every 12 years. If we think of the biggest festival in the UK, it probably was Glastonbury. The busiest day at Glastonbury, on the busiest day at Glastonbury, there are probably 250,000 people, 250,000 people present. On the busiest day at the Kumbh Mela, there are 25 million people. And this is from a standing start of a dry riverbed. The wandering sadhus begin to arrive 3 months or so before the festival begins. They then begin to set out their encampments. And then for the 12 days the festival runs. It is one of the largest cities on the planet. And then 3 months afterwards, it's gone. It's disappeared. It's back to a dry riverbed outside Allahabad. And I met these two sadhus at the gate, and they led me through the back streets of this little makeshift city. They took me to their encampment, led me into a little side area. I was stripped naked, and I was given a cloth to wear around, a kakoi to wear around my waist, and a little T-shirt, and a necklace which had one bead on it. And that bead meant to all Hindus that I was now a novice sadhu. And then I was shown to the holy fire, which was to be kept going through all hours of the festival. And their guru was sitting on a slightly raised platform about this high, above all the other sadhus who were sitting around this fire. And I sat down, and several of the sadhus spoke very good English, And so I started conversation. And as I was speaking to them, they were rolling joints. They were stuffing pipes full of hashish. And they explained to me very carefully that the smoking of hashish was a religious act, and it was to still the noise of their minds so that they could meet with and commune with the divine, with Shiva. And they were passing this hash pipe round, and it came to me, and they handed it to me, and I looked at the director, and he went... And so I took a couple of draws on it, and for the next 3 or 4 days, I was stoned out of my mind. And when I say at festivals sadhus smoke hashish, they don't just smoke it sort of after dinner. They smoke it continually, and very quickly, as a result of the hash smoking and the fact that it's like being immersed in a cup final 24 hours a day, you lose all sense of time and place and rhythm. Some sadhus will sleep all day and then get up at 5 in the afternoon, light up a chillum, and then carry on right the way through till 7 in the morning, and then they'll go to bed again. And so everything got completely muddled. After about 2 or 3 days, I was sitting around the fire at about 6 o'clock one morning, and the guru was there, and he said, Mr. Peter, you don't look very well. And I said, no, I'm fine, I'm fine. And he said, no, you must tell me what the matter is. And so I said, well, to be honest, I can't sleep. And he said, you can't sleep? And I said, no, I can't. He went, well, why? Why on earth not? And I went, well, the noise. You can't hear the noise? And he got a bit peeved with me. I could sense he was getting very impatient with me. And so he sort of stood up. He picked up his mat. And outside our little encampment was a thoroughfare, probably about 3 or 4 yards wide. It was just full of people coming and going all hours of the night. He lay his mat down in the middle of the thoroughfare. He lay down on it. And he went to sleep. And I was leaning up against this corrugated iron fence, just checking that he wasn't faking it. And then I went into the camp an hour after leaning up against the corrugated iron fence, and people were treading on him, falling over him, and he was out like a baby, just sleeping. And he came in with that bedhead about 2.5 hours later, and he called me over. And he said, you call yourself this holy man? This priest, you cannot even sleep when you want to. You are a baby. You're a baby. You have so much to learn. And he was right. He was right. After about 3 or 4 days, the director came and said, the hash has got to go. And so I went, okay, why? And he said, because everything I've shot with you in it is completely unusable. And if you see the first 3 or 4 minutes of Extreme Pilgrim in India, I'm not in it. I'm not in it at all. There's one shot of me in the background, and I'm just standing there having a conversation, but most of all, I'm just like this. And then about 3 or 4 days after the hash went, the two sadhus who had been so kind and looked after me, I was sitting around the fire, and they just came and tapped me on the shoulder and said, we're going now. And I went, now? And they went, yeah, right now. And they meant now. They don't have anything to pack. They just have one bag and the clothes they're standing up in. And so they were going now. And I said, please, just give us 10 minutes. So I had to say to the director, we're going now, we're going now. And then, so we left the camp. I followed them out of the Kumbh Mela, and we just went on the road. I have never spent 2.5 weeks laughing as much as I did in all of my life, rolling around on the floor laughing. They were so funny, and they were laughing as well. And I would say, please, please, I cannot laugh anymore. And they would go, but Peter, this life is a gift to you to enjoy. And I've never met two men who just enjoyed being alive so much as they did. And they gave me that. And I loved it. The dogs chased us. They laughed. We arrived late. Women spat at us. Men spat at us. They laughed. And we had this little routine after a couple of weeks. We'd arrive in a little village, and within most Indian villages that are Hindu, there's a little shrine, rather like we will have a church, and the sadhus would sort of be greeted as they walked into the village. They'd then go and sort of sit in the shrine, and some of the villagers would come and ask them really some incredible questions about the meaning of life and the purpose of love. And then they'd send me out with the bowl to get some food because I was this novelty sadhu with blonde hair. And they thought they'd get better results as that. And then I'd come back, and then they'd light their chillum, and we'd talk into the night about love and God and wine and sex. And it was an incredible time. And I felt the sort of liberation, truly, of not owning a thing. Of having nothing. And it's like a tangible weight being lifted off your shoulders. After 2.5 weeks, most of us who were filming from the BBC got very sick. I got giardia, and the director got amoebic dysentery. And so he said, right, I'm cutting this short by one day, and we're going to go back to Delhi. We'll get a night's sleep, and then we'll fly back to London, and we'll get in a cab and go to the Center for Tropical Diseases and get some injections when we arrive. And on our way back, we stopped in this little town to buy some water and some bananas, because that was all any of us could manage. And we had a wonderful translator. Her name was Lakshmi, and I could hear her calling me. She's going, Pete, come and see what I found. And so I crossed the road, and she was sitting on a slightly raised piece of concrete about as high as this platform. And she was sitting next to a man who was holding, a man in his sort of mid-20s, who was holding a baby girl in his arms. And on this piece of concrete, dancing around this piece of concrete, was a little girl of about 2 or 3. And then in the corner, up against some very roughly constructed breeze blocks, was a girl of about 8 or 9, and she was cooking on an open fire. And I sat down, and he explained that he had been a small farmer, and India is blessed with many, many small farmers, and that his wife had become unwell. And she'd become so unwell that he had to start selling some of his tools and his livestock to pay for the medicines that she needed. And she became so gravely ill, she had to go to hospital to pay for that. He had to sell his farm. And 6 weeks before I met him, she died. She died 6 weeks previously. And at no point during this conversation did he ask for money. He never asked for a cent. And so we listened. And then the translator said, thanked him. And then she said to him, well, we have to go back to our vehicles, because we're driving back to Delhi. And we stood up to go, and he put his hand on my shoulder. And he said, no, please, will you stay and eat with us? And so in rural India, you eat with your hands, which is a lovely experience. And so I had a little bit of rice and some okra. And we sat down and ate, and then we went back to our transport, and both the translator and I were in floods of tears. And I wish we'd filmed that. I wish that encounter had been filmed, because if I experience in my life another act of generosity, which is so completely full of grace as that one was, I will be a lucky man. And that degree of generosity changes us individually, because it teaches us the true potential beauty of the human soul, the human spirit. Has anyone been to the Sinai Desert? Yes, one or two people. I'm leading a retreat in the Sinai Desert in October. I can't wait to go back. For us, living in rainy, gorgeous, green England, deserts can be very brutal places. And the bit of the Sinai I was staying in was behind St. Anthony's Monastery, and there was barely any organic life there at all. Occasionally, there were lots of flies, and occasionally I would see some birds, but there was nothing else. And I was living in a cave for 3.5 weeks on my own. And before I got there, I thought, I'm going to have to do something. The Coptic Egyptian monk who lent me his cave had instructed me on a very, very strict prayer routine, which I had to follow. But I thought, I'm going to have times in between that. And so I thought I would write a series of letters to people that had informed my sense of self, to people and entities that had really illuminated me. And so I wrote one every day. And they were published. When I returned home, they were published in a book, and this book with this horrible title called Letters from an Extreme Pilgrim. It was meant to be called Letters from the Moon, because that was what I felt I'd landed on. And would you like to hear the last letter from the last day? Okay. I thought I'd write to St. Anthony. St. Anthony was the founder of Christian monasticism. Without St. Anthony, there would be no Celtic saints. There would be no tradition of men and women taking to the wild places to live lives of contemplation and prayer. So I thought I would write to him as I was staying not far from where his cave was. Okay. Dear Saint Anthony, I must admit I struggle with the notion of saints, but having read your biography and having read what you have to say about this eternally mysterious relationship between God and human beings, there is no doubt in my mind that you reached a place and that you continually reached for a place there in the center of your being, your soul, where you were only ever aware of the presence of God and how everything is held in that presence. Your cave in the eastern desert is about a 45-minute walk from here, so perhaps you went this way once or twice. And the birds are still here, the birds whose ancestors apparently fed you, brought you bread. They still climb in the thermals in their slow circular motion without ever moving a feather, it would seem, as they measure or become the current. Is that the secret? And the spring from which you must have drunk has dried up now, and the monks who live down on the plain drive these huge tankers, bringing water into the monastery you founded. And the monastery could not now exist without those deliveries. And sometimes, if the wind is coming from the south, I can hear the monastery bell being tolled for morning and evening prayer. It's very faint, though, and it's as if I might have imagined it. And about 10 days ago, I thought I heard a donkey braying. And again, if there is a slight wind, I can almost make out the whir of a generator. But I'm not sure. As you know, this is the land of silence. Christ said, "In my Father's house, there are many rooms. This is the silent room." And as you know, there are millions of others, and we ourselves can inhabit thousands. There are so many to choose from. I'm quite sure the universe is full of countless billions of rooms that I can't even imagine. Did you choose solitude? Or did God lead you into solitude? Or were you never truly alone without God as your guide, your light, your companion? I know, too, that the Father of Darkness also kept you company, and you fought what you describe as demons. Spiritual, physical manifestations born in darkness, hating light, which were sent to tear your being, to quite literally prevent you from praying and maintaining your relationship with God. When I first arrived here, I was afraid, and I was angry that God should cast us into a world where we can become preyed upon by the forces of evil. How could a loving father do this? Send his children out to play among forces that can tear them apart. But I've been here for several weeks now, and I realize that it was my choice to come here. My choice of room, as it always is, as it was yours. I had been so confused, and in that confusion weakened to the point where I blamed everyone else for the state I was in. But now I understand that I chose that state. I chose those rooms. And I see now that every single action is a choice between the light and the dark. I had thought choices were merely about survival or even about pleasure, that pleasure was a justifiable choice all of its own. I had no idea that everything we touch, everything we are, and all that we choose to experience is actually a choice between dark and light. Nor did I understand how very sensitive we are to both those states, how with one there is the experience of increasing weightlessness, while the other is heavy. Why is pleasure heavy and joy light? And since you died, some of your words have been written down, and since then, many men and women have taken to the wildernesses, the quiet rooms, trying to follow your example. About 1,600 years ago, these men and women were almost commonplace in the land where I grew up. They, like you, took to caves and cliffs. They even built tiny cells out of reeds. But there are hardly any of us left now. Hardly any on the planet. Perhaps no more than 500 souls who have chosen this way of life, living in these rooms, sleeping on stones and living on bread and dust. In my country, it's actually against the law to live that way. If you do, you're called a vagrant. If I were to erect a small cell on Dartmoor or inhabit a fissure in the Torridon Rocks, even in the far reaches of the Gannet Kingdom of St. Kilda, or as close to the sky as I could find on Skult Head in North Norfolk, I would be moved on. The police would be called, and a pile of papers would be thrust into my hands explaining that my actions were inappropriate and unlawful. And if I refused to go, I would be forcibly arrested. Maybe somewhere in the Canadian tundra I could manage it, but apart from that, I would need permission to live in the wilderness. I needed permission to come here. There is always the moon, of course. Good and evil does not exist up here on the moon, and the silence is complete. This is a world of silence, pregnant, waiting, enduring. Sometimes I think pleading for life. It has life in that it exists, and it has landscapes and moods. But the food up here on the moon is passable enough. But as my thoughts drift, the chicken tastes exactly the same as the carrots, which taste exactly the same as the chocolate cake, so I can't really taste anything anymore. And the water is neither hot nor cold. I have two glasses, but they are the same size. So really, I can't tell the difference between them. I have two sets of clothes. They, too, are identical. Sometimes I imagine the shadows on the mountains are areas of heather, and rising up between them are rowan and birches. And I've traced streams across the contours of the rocks leading into the valleys where there are meadows stitched with flowers, and I can hear the sound of bees. And there is a woman coming towards me. And with each step, her eyes grow more intense. And she says, "Come, come and see what I've found." And we walk along a small wooded path to a gate. And through the gate, there is an orchard. And there are children playing, riding lions, and adults sleeping among peacocks. And suddenly a man appears at the gate and asks, "Are you sure you want to come through?" And he looks at us closely and he goes on, "If you do come through the gate, everything you need will be provided for you, and so you won't feel need anymore. And as for love, there is no separation here between love and hatred. It's just love. There is no desire to love, no desire to hate. There's no fear. There's just being. You can stay here as long as you want to. Not that you'll be aware of time anymore. There is no good and evil here. So your struggle will be over. There are no decisions to make between the two, because beyond this gate, neither exists. Is it heaven? Asks the woman. No, no, it's not heaven. We have no need of heaven here. Heaven is another room. You go to heaven to be healed. We never get sick here. There's no such thing as pain. What about pleasure? I ask. No, there is joy. We are not weighed down with pleasure. What about rules? Asks the woman. Well, there is only one rule, and if you break it, you have to leave. Then you can no longer stay here. Does anyone ever break it? The woman questions. There was a couple once, yes, a long time ago, but they've gone now. And he looks at us again. It isn't a difficult decision. We smile. We say goodbye. We walk away in silence, a little afraid, I think. Oh, come on, says the woman. Come on, let's run and skip and shout and scream and love and hate and dance and eat and win and lose and cry and laugh, grow old and die. Yes, let's do that, I say. There we are. Thank you. Thank you so much. My time is up. I'm sorry I can't take any questions. I have a few books if people would like some signed copies. Otherwise, I came to Greenbelt 15 years ago, and this is a very, very different experience now. Coming in through the gates this morning, I could sense this feeling of joy, of delight. And I can honestly say I did not feel that when I first came here. So thank you all for bringing that with you. Thank you.